Well, good morning. My name is Steve Holstein. I am one of the pastors here at Faith Community, and I want to welcome you again. We are so glad that you're here. We want to do everything that we can to help everyone meet, know, and follow Jesus. We want everyone to have an authentic, thriving, growing relationship with Him. Now, last week, as we looked at how an authentic relationship with Jesus affects our view of technology, Tim Porter taught us about some important aspects of our conscience from the Bible. He introduced us to our consciences, and he showed us the Bible says that you should never violate your conscience. Your conscience is your conscience, their conscience is their conscience, and you have to guard against putting your conscience on them. No conscience perfectly aligns with God's will. And finally, and maybe most importantly, your conscience can be damaged. You can either make it insensitive by violating it over and over again, or you can make it oversensitive by making too many rules about things which actually are just matters of opinion. The use of technology does challenge our consciences, and today I'm going to talk about another area where we are prone to violate all of these biblical principles. That's the area of political convictions. Did you feel that? The level of tension in the room just increased. I just brought up politics and religion, the two things that you are never supposed to bring up in polite conversation unless you know that everyone in the room agrees. And guess what? I've talked to enough of you over the years to know that we don't all agree on how an authentic relationship with Jesus should affect our politics. For example, some of our consciences only allow voting for candidates who share our convictions on a single critical issue. Others think a candidate's entire platform and character should be considered. Each by voting otherwise would violate their conscience, yet either by condemning the other's conscience wrongly judges their brother and presumes that their conscience matches better with God's will. And in judging, neither is very likely to think that their own conscience might be damaged or oversensitive. I've also seen enough of our social media posts to know that we can be passionate advocates and critics of our political positions. Now, who knowing all of that would be foolish enough to preach on this topic? Maybe the guy who's closest to retirement, huh? And not that I'm looking for an early retirement, mind you. Or maybe it's the guy whose youthful foolishness exposes some of the human tendencies in this realm. You see, the tension that crept into the room when I mentioned politics and religion in the same breath is not at all new. It was present 2,000 years ago in Jesus' time between two groups that represented the religious right and advocates of left-leaning cultural accommodation. It's also existed in the ancient days of the 1960s when my political conscience was forming. In the 1970s when I was in student government, and in the 1980s when I worked for the governor of the state of Kansas. So I'd like you to join me on a quick trip back to 1968. The Vietnam War is in full swing. The nation is as close to violent internal conflict as any time during our history other than the Civil War. The war abroad and civil rights issues here at home are dominating the national news. The youth of the country are in open rebellion against the military draft and against all the institutions that they perceive as being controlled by older generations. The previous year, racial tensions had boiled over in Detroit riots. And as 1968 begins, the Tet Offensive in Vietnam kills more American soldiers in a single week in the first week of February than at any other time during the war. And each night, the nightly news brings death and destruction from the streets of Saigon right into the family room of the Holstein household in North Platte, Nebraska. And one night, as I watched the news, a South Vietnamese general walked up on one of the streets in Saigon where some South Vietnamese soldiers were holding a Viet Cong prisoner and shot him point blank in the temple. It was the first time that I had ever seen a human being killed. And it absolutely stunned my conscience, even though the Viet Cong was our enemy. Within the month, Walter Cronkite, the CBS News anchor who had 28 million viewers each evening and was named the most trusted man in America by the Gallup poll, started to editorialize that negotiation needed to bring the war to a conclusion. Soon thereafter, Bobby Kennedy entered the presidential race, and his campaign brought him to North Platte. His promise to end the war and to seek racial and intergenerational reconciliation struck my 10-year-old conscience as being consistent with the Christian principles of love, peace, and justice. So I rode my bicycle downtown to the storefront where his local campaign was, and I shelled out a buck for the biggest pin-on Kennedy button that I could find. I can't vote, but I can put Bobby's face and name in front of people who can. And I started wearing that button to school religiously every day. There, my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Mabel Christensen, engaged me about the button. She was a politically conservative Nixon supporter. Mrs. Christensen was 60. She sometimes in the morning read the Bible to us. Her son, Dan, was an artist who lived in New York City. His painting, Red Red, had recently been highlighted in Time magazine as representative of the countercultural arts movement. It was anything but traditional. She told the class she didn't think it was art. I thought it was pretty cool. So anyway, when she asked me about my Kennedy button, I thought for sure she was going to tell me to stop wearing it to class. Instead, after hearing my reasons for supporting Bobby, she said, "Well, I don't like him, but that's okay." What I thought was going to be a tense moment in the most divisive political season of the last century was mild. Mrs. Christensen and I were very different, but I liked her. And I think she liked me. So now let's just pretend for a moment that our interaction happened with the same candidates and the same set of issues, but it happened in the environment and atmosphere of the last presidential election. Instead of getting our news from Walter Cronkite each evening, we've been fed stories throughout the day on our mobile devices. As I click on stories about Bobby Kennedy more frequently, and Mrs. Christensen reads more about Richard Nixon, the algorithms in our news apps start sending more and more news to us about each one of them. They also channel to us more negative stories about their opponents. All these stories, both positive and negative, now include editorial comment from experts within the reporting. These experts reassure us that our candidates are right and good, and the other side is wrong and bad. And that makes us feel good. So we click on more stories, extending our screen time and earning more money for those media providers. The perspective that we are getting is increasingly one-sided. So Mrs. Christensen starts believing that only Fox News will be fair to the right and adequately critique left-leaning views. I begin to think only MSNBC won't distort progressive positions and hold the right accountable. In the evening, she starts to watch Hannity. He convinces her that she should be enraged by the evil of left-wing conspiracies. I start watching Rachel Maddow. She convinces me that only snarky ridicule will put those right-wing monsters in their place. We're now each certain that the other side is evil. So we start to ignore the failings and inconsistencies of our own candidate. We dismiss reports about those as fake news. And we feel justified in whatever we say or do because we've met the enemy, and the enemy is completely other than us. We feel as though our consciences are clean. And armed with that self-assured purity of our cause and the utter depravity of our opponents, Mrs. Christensen and I proudly display our political convictions on social media. There we don't have to look the people we disagree with in the eye. We can just hurl our condemnation at each other like slanderous Molotov cocktails. And when the enemies of our enemy join us in liking our posts, we feel this sense of tribal camaraderie. But the anti-Kennedy and anti Nixon tribes that we belong to share little in common beyond a self-righteous distaste for our common enemy. And in the end, Mrs. Christensen and I end up feeling this deep sense of anxiety and isolation and agitation. We are alienated from each other. Now, I've just spun a kind of a fanciful fable based on Ben Sasse's penetrating analysis from the book Them. There he surveys the way that technology has created an echo chamber business model for the news media. It's a model that tells us what our itching ears really want to hear. It reinforces our existing biases and demonizes those who disagree with us. It's creating waves of us versus them polarization in our political culture centered around what Sasse calls anti-tribes. He points to this trend as the primary cause for one of the most divisive political climates that we have experienced since the 1960s. But more important for those who follow Jesus, this process can create a damaged and lopsided conscience in us. In this series, we're learning that identities anchored in Jesus can give us a firm mooring in the stormy waters of isolation and anxiety that the technological revolution is bringing into our lives. And Jesus' perspective on politics, as revealed in today's lesson, has transformative hope for the way that we relate to each other in this realm of life. You know, we all want to live by our convictions, but Jesus wants us to develop and display those convictions in a way that forms his image in us and inscribes his name on all of our actions and attitudes. So today, we'll be looking at a story about Jesus that comes from the book of Mark. Mark is a short, action-packed history of Jesus' ministry. Scholars tell us that Peter, one of Jesus' closest disciples, gave an eyewitness account of these events to Mark. He recorded them so that we could have a trustworthy report of what happened. The passage that we're going to be reading today is in the 12th chapter of Mark's book, and it records an incident of Jesus' opponents trying to use a political controversy to entrap him. It's relevant to our political reality because the people questioning Jesus really are the ultimate anti-tribe. The only common ground that they share is their conviction that Jesus is the ultimate evil. So let's read together this account of Jesus' response to the kind of political reality that we often face. You'll find the story on page 848 of the Bibles that are underneath the chairs in front of you, and we'll also be projecting it on the screens above if you'd like to follow along there. Mark 12, 13 through 17. And they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap him in his talk. And they came and said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are true and do not care about anyone's opinion. For you are not swayed by appearances, but truly teach the way of God. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not?" But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, "Why put me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." And they brought one, and he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." Jesus said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they marveled at him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So let's begin with a little bit of background. First, this event takes place in Jerusalem, which is the center of Jewish religious, cultural, and civic life during Jesus' time. But it's ruled by Pontius Pilate, a governor of the Roman Empire. He answers to the Roman Emperor Tiberius, whose title is Caesar. This emperor actually claims to be a god. He demands that his subjects revere him and pay him the tax of a denarius, the rough equivalent of a day's wages, simply because he is their divine sovereign. Second, this event occurred in the week between Palm Sunday, which we celebrate today, and Good Friday, when Jesus was executed by the Romans at the urging of Jewish leaders. And third, who are these Pharisees and Herodians? Well, the text tells us that they want to trap Jesus with their question. They ask if it's right under Jewish religious law to pay this tax to Caesar. They want to ensnare Jesus in a conflict between religious convictions and civic conscience. If there was ever an anti-tribe in politics, as I said before, this is it. The Pharisees might be thought of as the religious right of Jesus' time. They object to paying tribute to a foreign ruler who also claims to be a god. The God of Israel says, "You shall have no god besides him," and he commands the Jews to honor him as their sole sovereign and king. If Jesus says his countrymen should pay this unpopular tax, the Pharisees will accuse him of violating their legalistic version of obeying God's commands. Obeying the religious rules is their image of good. If you don't comply, you're evil. The Herodians, on the other hand, are more like the progressive left. Their image of good is peaceful coexistence. They're Jews who collaborate with the Romans. Cultural and political compromise with the empire is their pragmatic way to maintain the peace. If that compromise brings some of their countrymen's religious convictions into question, or it pinches their pocketbooks, so be it. That's better than bloodshed. Their image of good is to use political power to prevent massive suffering. So if Jesus incites rebellion by saying it's unlawful to pay taxes to Caesar on religious grounds, he's evil in their eyes. Now, these two groups have very different ideas of what is good, but their consciences are molded by more than just kind of high-minded principles. Their convictions align pretty neatly with their personal interests. And Jesus threatens those interests. On Palm Sunday, which we celebrate today, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. Doesn't seem that significant, but this simple act was a symbolic claim by Jesus to being king of the Jews. That's a direct threat to the Herodians, who rule as agents of the Roman Empire in the rest of Jewish Palestine. If Jesus sparks a rebellion, the Romans will crush it and the Herodians will lose their position of civic power. And once in Jerusalem, Jesus also challenges the structure that gives the Pharisees their place of status, power, and respect in Jewish society. He goes to the temple and throws out all the money changers and the merchants who sell doves for poor worshipers to sacrifice. The dove sellers just happen to be relatives of the high priest, and they have a virtual monopoly on the trade, which allows them to charge sky-high prices. Moreover, after clearing the temple, Jesus tells the crowd a parable. It compares Jerusalem's religious leaders to tenants of a vineyard who murder the owner's son when he arrives to take charge of what belongs to his father. The Pharisees, they see that Jesus is turning the people against the existing religious order. They are on the verge of losing their power. So suddenly, the Herodians and the Pharisees have a shared interest. Jesus threatens not only their convictions, but their self-interests. He is their common enemy. And as the saying in politics goes, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They conspire to murder Jesus with what they think is a clear conscience, because to them, he is the ultimate evil. Now, before we go any further, maybe it's time to ask ourselves a couple of questions. First, are our political convictions putting us in alliance with those whose actions and attitudes don't honor God simply because they are the enemy of my enemy? Here's another question. How often do our political convictions require us to sacrifice some advantage of wealth, status, or power? If you're like me, not very often. Does that mean any policy that's personally good for me or protects my interest is wrong? Not necessarily, but it may mean that some of my self-serving motives have deformed my conscience in certain areas. And maybe, with a clear conscience, I can join the Pharisees and Herodians in plotting harm for my political opponents. As I told you, my political conscience started to form in the 1960s, but in the 1970s, it started to crystallize. In 1975, I was a senior at Ralston High School in Omaha, Nebraska. I was student body president, and I was frustrated. I had tried all year to get the school administrators to change their policy that athletes had to have short hair to be on a school team. My convictions were entirely based on the Christian principle that God looks at the interior and not the exterior. Well, maybe not entirely. This is the picture that my wife refers to as the Adam's apple with hair. One of my friends several years ago, when I showed him the picture, said, "Wow, your sister was hot." Well, anyway, our principal hadn't yielded to the student council's pleas. And based on my conviction that our God-given liberty was being unfairly restricted, I felt totally justified in writing a scathing editorial in the student newspaper. The coaches and administration told us they wanted their athletes to present a clean-cut image for the school. So I wrote about all the ways that their actions didn't meet their standards. And to prove my point, one section of my letter detailed how one of the coaches had showed up at school with lots of cuts and bruises. The rumor was that he'd been in a drunken brawl at a local bar. I presented that rumor as a fact. I was willing, with a clear conscience, to ridicule him in front of the entire student body and faculty. I was willing to murder this man's reputation just to prove my case. Thankfully, there was no Facebook or Instagram in those days where I could instantly post my rant. Instead, I showed the draft of my letter to one of my friends to get a few quick likes. And instead, he told me that if everything he knew about me was in the school paper, I'd be humiliated. So I removed the most slanderous part, but what remained was still reeking of self-righteous indignation. When it was published, I got lots of positive feedback from the students, but I alienated the principal and coaches. And I didn't change a single opinion any more than most of our social media posts do. I'd only made each side feel more certain that they were good and their opponents were evil. What was it that my friends saw in my willingness to slander a coach's reputation? It was the same thing that Jesus saw in the anti-tribe that interrogated him. Hypocrisy. It wasn't the hypocrisy of not living according to convictions. The Pharisees believed Jesus was a heretic. The Herodians believed that he threatened their peaceful coexistence with Rome. I believed I should be judged by the content of my character, not someone else's standards of external virtue. What Jesus sees in the Herodians and Pharisees, what he sees in me, what he sees in all of us, is that we have a selective hypocrisy that applies our imperfect conscience to our opponents as the litmus test to prove that they are evil and we are good. Once we've demonized our opponents, we can slander them, we can entrap them, we can even murder them. So Jesus asks his interrogators, "Why put me to the test?" His implied question is, "Why don't you test yourselves? You know you're fabricating a reason to kill me. That violates God's laws and Caesar's laws." And then he shows them the depth of their hypocrisy by asking a second question about the coin used to pay Caesar's tax. Whose likeness and inscription is this? This is a particularly penetrating question for the Pharisees, who think of themselves as the guardians of God's law. You see, the second commandment of God's law is, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." This commandment protected God's people from worshiping idols. In the ancient world, all gods except the God of Israel were represented as images engraved in stone or wood or metal. These images typically had human or animal qualities that symbolized the god's particular powers and the realm of creation where he supposedly ruled. The New Testament book of Romans says that in doing this, men exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. The immortal, invisible, all-powerful God of Israel, who rules over everything seen and unseen, could never be contained or trapped within the confines of any kind of image. And the Pharisees, in certain circumstances, were willing to die rather than violate their conscience's understanding of this law. The Jewish historian Josephus records that when Pontius Pilate first came to Jerusalem, he placed banners in the city. They said something on them, and the religious Jews went to Pilate to demand removal of those banners. They said that what was on the banners violated the second commandment. Pilate promptly surrounded them with soldiers, threatening to kill them if they didn't leave. So they bared their necks, refusing to move until he either relented or executed them on the spot. Pilate relented, and he removed the banners. What was on those banners that so offended their consciences? Caesar's likeness and an inscription that read, "Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus, Augustus." A declaration that Tiberius was the son of the emperor god Augustus and equal in divinity. So imagine how the Pharisees must have felt as Jesus showed them their coin and asked them the question that exposed a gaping hole in their consciences. Whose likeness and inscription is this? I can imagine an extended silence before they said, "Caesar's." Jesus had just shown them that the currency of their hearts carried all the traits of Caesar. The idol that offends their conscience on a banner, they're happy to carry privately in their pocket if it enriches them. And they'll adopt their oppressor's brutal tactics if it will establish their version of good and eliminate their opponent. They'll die to defend one part of the law, and they will kill in violation of another part if it will protect their personal interests. They carry the image of Caesar on more than their coins. Caesar's attitudes and actions have formed their political consciences in ways that now show that they have a worldly sovereign. His name is inscribed on their compromised consciences. They have already paid Caesar the tribute that he seeks. Whose likeness and inscription does our political conscience project? It's not just a question of whether the policy positions that we take can be specifically or indirectly traced back to biblical principles. It's also a question of the demeanor of our political conversations, our tactics in gaining influence and power, our collaboration with unsavory allies. Does the sum total of our participation in the political process project the image and inscription of Christ? Or does it reflect the image of Caesar? Is there any hypocrisy that I need to confess? That you need to confess? As I told you at the start, in the 1980s, I worked for the governor of Kansas. As I engaged in politics and government full-time, some of the distortions of conscience that the Bible outlines became pretty prominent in me. It wasn't that I worked for legislation that opposed God's good commands. In fact, I'd say that much of the legislation I worked on aimed to implement principles like justice, mercy, and doing good for my neighbor. Instead, it was the attitudes that developed in the competitive struggle to maintain power and the oppositional process of partisan conflict. It started with judging the advocates of opposing legislative positions by rules of my political conscience. And the more that I judged them, the more I questioned their motives. The more I believed their motives were bad, the more I called them names, dismissed their concerns, and ridiculed them. The more I ridiculed them, the less my conscience was troubled. And the less my conscience was troubled, the more I felt justified in my own political judgments, and more than that, justified by my political judgments. They aligned pretty well with God's will according to my highly selective conscience. He became my excuse for why I could behave badly in pursuing good. And in my self-assured goodness, I started compromising more and more areas of conscience that had nothing to do with politics. But Jesus' response to the hypocrisy of those of us who use God to justify our incomplete and deformed political consciences should cause us to marvel at him. He says, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God what is God's." Don't you marvel at what Jesus doesn't do? Having disarmed his opponents by exposing their hypocrisy, he didn't denounce them in righteous indignation or even dismiss their question. He knows they're trying to kill him, and yet he treats them with respect. So here's a practical point of application. If we want to cultivate the image and inscription of Christ on our political consciences, as I said, in the limited exposure I've had to our social media, I've noticed that we're prone to use litmus test issues, political parties, and ideologies that our consciences embrace as a way to subtly, sometimes not so subtly, judge others. What if the next time that you saw a post that you disagreed with, the first thing you did was pray for that person? Not a prayer like, "Oh Lord, enlighten these poor fools." What a prayer like, "God, do them good." And then, instead of clicking a dislike or tweeting a snarky commentator's opinion piece or even posting a comprehensive rebuttal to their position, instead, you invited them to coffee and you asked them to talk about the convictions that led to their position. What if you listened to try to understand instead of trying to immediately respond? Then you ask them to point out any hypocrisy they might see in your position. And then finally, before you respond, you thank them and tell them that your convictions you hold humbly because the Jesus that you follow is humble. More than winning any political argument, you want to look like him. And the reason that looking like him would be your priority is contained in Jesus' response to his opponent's questions. By saying, "Render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's," Jesus is recognizing that government has a legitimate but limited role. At their best, laws of earthly governments can restrain evil deeds imperfectly for a time. But laws can never constrain the evil that is in a human heart, vindicate its hypocrisy, or cleanse its pollutive motives. But there's a king who rode into Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, who can write his law on human hearts. His plan doesn't depend on which political party is in power, which presidential candidate is elected, which Supreme Court justice is confirmed. He has sovereign authority over everything. Caesar's pitiful claim to divinity isn't worth comparing to his power and authority. Yet, he is supremely humble. He's a king who died to pay for the hypocrisy of Herodians and Pharisees, of progressives and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, libertarians and socialists, you and me. He alone has been raised to death to sit at the right hand of the one who sees the hypocritical consciences that we have deformed by sin. And as our eternal judge looks upon us, Jesus alone can respond to the question, whose image and inscription is this? And can answer, Father, they are mine. They are firmly anchored in me. Jesus alone can grant us a clean conscience before the one ruler who will judge the deepest motives of our flawed convictions. Will you render to God what is God's? Jesus is calling you to make him king of your life. If you've never said yes to him, he stands ready to receive your appeal for a good conscience before God through his resurrection from the dead, which we will celebrate joyously next weekend. And if you've already given your life to Jesus, would you join me in saying yes to him refining your conscience in ways that form his image in you and stamp his inscription on every aspect of our actions and attitudes, even our politics? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your Son, Jesus. His death on the cross has purchased for us the forgiveness of our every hypocrisy. His resurrection has vindicated our compromised consciences, made us one with him in your judgments, and you have adopted us in him as your beloved sons and daughters. His promised return gives us the hope of a just and perfect government over all creation, and a new heavens and a new earth. We place our trust in him and ask that by your Holy Spirit, you would continue to form his likeness in us as you inscribe his name upon our hearts. Amen.